Great. And so now we're ready to begin our first talk. I am pleased to invite Peter Chin Hong, who's the to talk about infectious and other complications of the immunobiologic agents used by individuals with HIV infection. He is a professor of medicine at UCSF.
Thanks to the organizers for having me, and good morning, everybody, for those who made it and battled all the coffee lines. How is everyone doing this morning? Good? That's great. So I'm going to talk about a lot of immunobiologics this morning. I'm not going to really discern all the specific side effects and mechanisms of actions of each of them because they're quite daunting. First of all, it's daunting just to pronounce them. So I had to look at myself in the mirror this morning and like pronounce drugs over and over again. But what I'm going to do is give you an approach to these drugs because your patients are going to be on them. And I think one theme that I will give to you is that it really behooves us to take ownership of these drugs and not really relinquish them to subspecialists because you're beside the patient anyway and you're going to see some of the untoward side effects first before anyone will. So I have research support from a diagnostics molecular diagnostics company. So my aims are to really list the type of conditions. It's going to be very straightforward for which we're using biologics today in 2018. I'm briefly going to talk about the mechanisms of action, but not in great detail. And I'm going to talk about it in the way that in which you can describe it to your patients in one sentence. We're going to describe the array of infectious, but also other complications that may arise with these agents, and things that you have to look out for. And finally, we're going to talk about prevention and what sort of measures you need to take before starting and during starting, medication, while the patient is on medications in your HIV-infected patients. So first of all, as you know, HIV-infected patients are living longer. We heard in HIV 101 that pretty much when a patient comes to you for the intake visit, you tell them that you're going to pretty much have a normal life expectancy on antiretroviral therapy. But what that means is that as patients have generally a normal life span, they're going to get more autoimmune disease and more malignancies. This is also couched in the fact that in the broader context, that actually we've been declining life expectancy in the United States, as many of you know, in the last 2 years due to the opioid epidemic and the increased suicide rate. So it's a little bit sobering in that sense, but nevertheless, increased life expectancy in HIV-infected patients. So these are some of the conditions that your patients are going to have. So I want those people in the audience to raise their hands if you've had a patient with either any one of these, rheumatoid arthritis, vasculitis, Crohn's disease, psoriasis, lymphoma, or any of these malignancies. Pretty much everybody. So I would say that this talk is relevant to all HIV providers because your patients are going to be on one of these agents sometime or the other. Or they're going to be offered them, or somebody's going to talk about the risks and benefits of these agents. So for rheumatologic conditions, they're mainly TNF-alpha inhibitors, and they include drugs like infliximab, adalimumab, and etanercept. These include rheumatoid arthritis, vasculitis, Crohn's disease, psoriasis. For lymphoma, oldest drug in the pantheon of drugs here, rituximab. It's an anti-CD20 drug. And for the biggest development in drugs has been in the last row, which is in the melanoma, prostate cancer, lung cancer, leukemia, and increasing indications, head and neck cancer as we move on in time. And I'm going to briefly end with a discussion on checkpoint blockade drugs as well as CAR T cells. So what's a biologic? Well, it's really tough to describe what a biologic is because the definition is so broad, but it's really refers to any biologically derived product which binds or interferes with a specific molecular target. So the HIV drug, ipilimumab, is a biologic, but we're not going to talk about that in this context. I'm talking about biologics as we use to treat some of the conditions I mentioned in that first slide. So they could be monoclonal antibodies, receptor decoys or analogs, and chimeric small molecules. The abbreviations at the end of the drug can help you figure out what kind of mechanism is at play. So if it ends in sept, it refers to fusion of a receptor to the Fc part of human IgG. If it ends in mAb, it indicates a monoclonal antibody. If it ends in XIMAB, it indicates a chimeric monoclonal antibody, and ZUMAB indicates a humanized monoclonal antibody. So let's talk a little bit about immunosuppression now. So my daytime job is I run the immunocompromised host service at UCSF, so we see a broad range of patients from people on biologics to HIV-infected individuals with transplants to stem cell transplants. And it's really a range from those who've had a splenectomy to those who've had being treated with chemotherapy for solid tumors, for those who've had organ transplants, and even that it's a range from kidney transplants, which tend to do pretty well, to lung transplants, which tend to be fairly immunosuppressed. And then you get your allo-BMTs, which are, on the scale of things, probably the sickest patients that we see in the hospital. When you think about HIV infection, it's really overlaid on top of that immunosuppression in the background. So things can get quite complicated because you're talking about two axes, three dimensions. Sometimes I feel like I'm in Matrix, like running around in the hospital. Because it's really difficult to have a CD4 count, a general global immunosuppression scale of the patient in front of you. So that when we give drugs, the type of immune defect is related to the class of drugs or the type of drugs that we give. So there's adaptive immunity and innate immunity. In terms of innate immunity, they include your regular cancer chemotherapy drugs when your patients get neutropenic and their ANC drops down low, or if they have some innate problem like chronic granulomatous disease. The adaptive immunity drugs are harder to figure out and conditions. So the cell-mediated immunity drugs include TNF-alpha inhibitors, other biologics, and solid organ transplant drugs, for example. But not all drugs are created equally, and some drugs affect T-cells much more than other drugs. In terms of humoral immunity, these drugs include, so they mainly work on B-cells, and they include rituximab, as well as some other predisposing conditions. So how is this different from what we know about in HIV? Well, in HIV, the immune defect is due to the death of CD4 T cells, and this is really well worked out with these junctures like CD4 count of 200, CD4 count of 50, and we know that we can adjudicate what kinds of infections patients are at risk for based on the CD4 level they have. In non-HIV context, including these biologics, it's all over the map. So first of all, the immune defect is heterogeneous depending on what drugs you give. And we have no reliable tests available. I think people are working on assays, but it's really far from moving to clinical practice. So let's really understand the approach by taking a look at some of these cases. And these are all real cases from some of my colleagues around the world. And I don't have an audience response system in this talk because I want kind of an old-fashioned system. I'm going to have you at various junctures just turn to the person next to you, come up with an answer, and then somebody shout it out to me. I learned at some educational conference that we're kind of going back in time sometimes to try and engage the audience. I'm going to see if that works here. So 56-year-old woman with HIV, CD4 count of 360, viral load of who's undetectable with Crohn's disease, managed with infliximab and 6-mecaptopurine. She presents to the emergency department complaining of shortness of breath times 3 weeks. What else do you want to know? So turn to the person next to you. Try to pretend to be an ID doc or an HIV provider. You're not going to pretend to be that one. And the patient is in front of you and you're in the emergency department. What else do you want to know about this patient? And if you have nobody next to you, turn to the person behind you. Okay, I'm going to ask for somebody or people that volunteer to give me an answer. And this is called activating prior knowledge. I haven't told you anything yet, but I'm going to see what you guys remember from your experience. What is that? Oxygen. So you want to know her pulse ox, you know, how sick she is. So TB screening. So I'm thinking of a differential diagnosis too, and is she febrile along that? So what else, and anything else? What do ID docs ask every patient? It sounds kind of, where does she live exactly? Does she have any pets? Does she use the same toothbrush as a pet dog? I mean, we ask all those kinds of questions to patients. I mean, you'd be surprised what people do. Anyway, so we have more information based on what you guys have found out from each other. So the PPD is negative from prior. She lives in New York. This case comes from Boston. But she was visiting Boston at the time she went to the emergency department. But she had come back 4 weeks ago from a trip to Puerto Rico from where she visited family and helped with property cleanup after the hurricane. So this is kind of, you know, a little bit more complicated. But first, you know, but I think the audience was thinking about the thing that jumps to your mind first, which is TB, which is associated with TNF-alpha inhibitors. So I'm not going to ask you to talk to the person next to you for this one, but based on this knowledge, is there anything you're going to check next? What was that? Histoplasmosis, right? Wow, somebody, that's really advanced. Anything else? It kind of like stole my thunder, you know, like when the punchline for the joke comes up before you finish the joke. Anything else in general? Just basic stuff. Chest X-ray, and based on the chest X-ray, you decide whether or not you want to do AFB times 3 and other further exams. So. It turns out that the gentleman was correct. This ended up being a real case of histoplasmosis. There's histoplasmosis that occurs much beyond the Ohio and Mississippi River Valley that we learn about in nursing and medical school. And actually in the Caribbean, there's histo. Even in California, there's histo, even though we talk about cocci a lot of the times. Histo is very widespread. And the fact that she was helping clean up the property in the front yard after the hurricane unearthed all of the organisms in the soil, and she inhaled it while taking this biologic. So the chest X-ray was done, which was abnormal, showed these weird nodules, and then the chest CT scan, which is pictured, showed these very symmetric nodules, which was the radiologist think was very classic for some sort of fungal disease. They couldn't really tell you what. And then you do, of course, TB can look like everything, so you'd rule out for TB as well as check for the endemic mycoses. I would say that these are very difficult diagnoses to make a lot of times. At the first pass, you're probably going to think about TB, but then later on, if it doesn't, if the AFB smears are negative, you're going to go back to the patient and try and figure out some other risk association. So what is the data around TNF-alpha inhibitors and tuberculosis? There was a post-marketing survey of TB cases following the release of infliximab between 1998 and 2001, and that showed 70 cases of TB with a median time to diagnosis of 12 weeks. So it's not always noticed because it happens, there's a delayed reaction, and that's a key feature of many of these adaptive immunity-acting drugs. It's not like, you know, it's not the granulocytes that are being affected, the neutrophils, so the effect is a little bit delayed. And what was interesting was that the incidence of the prevalence in this case of extrapulmonary disease was much higher than the regular TB. So this was like TB happening in different organs, in the liver, in the bone, on the skin. So the TB that was happening with these TNF-alpha inhibitors was a little bit different. And what we know since that initial report was that Kevin Winthrop and others from Oregon did a really nice survey of serious infections on patients taking TNF-alpha inhibitors in the U.S. And we were starting to do a better job of TB and screening with QuantiFERONs before patients went on biologics. But look at histoplasmosis, like 56 cases compared to 17 cases of TB. And look at non-tuberculous mycobacteria like MAC, 32 cases versus 17 for TB. So again, I think we're doing a better job of TB, but we have to start thinking about the next level, which are these endemic mycoses and non-tuberculous mycobacteria. So in 2008, the FDA actually issued an alert with 256 cases of histoplasmosis in patients taking TNF-alpha inhibitors. And on the map, you can see in the different endemic mycoses, just a review, associated with different parts of the U.S. In the brown, there's blastomycosis, which we don't really see quite commonly, but histoplasmosis, tons of that in the turquoise. In the purple is the new kid in town, Cryptococcus gattii, which even immunocompetent patients can get, as opposed to Cryptococcus neoformans in HIV-infected individuals. And in the nice sort of lime green is Coxie. And I live in Coxie country, so we see a lot of coccidioidomycosis. Next case. This case comes from Hong Kong. And it happens in the winter, so put yourself in that situation when we have the peer share for the next time. 42-year-old male with Crohn's disease for 3 years. He was started on infliximab, a TNF-alpha inhibitor, after persistent diarrhea 5 months prior. He was admitted with 3 weeks of shortness of breath, low-grade temperatures, dry cough, no help with amoxicillin for weeks. So in Hong Kong, they treat their community-acquired pneumonia with amoxicillin as first-pass outpatients, so it's their Z-pack, so to speak. So what's your differential diagnosis? So turn to the same person next to you. For the next few seconds, think about the differential diagnosis. You're in Hong Kong. This is the winter. And somebody comes in with 3 weeks of shortness of breath. And just think of three or four things. And he's taking a biologic. Any thoughts? Differential diagnosis? Suggestions? You can just shout it out. You can say the obvious things too, because it's a review of sorts. So mycobacterial disease, I heard, bacterial pneumonia, that's not responsive to amoxicillin. Anything else? What? Oh, melioidosis from Southeast Asia. Very good thought. Pneumocystis. And why do you say pneumocystis, Laura? Because Laura trained in San Francisco and she saw a lot of pneumocystis. But it's true. I mean, I think my point to this audience is that you have to think broadly when people come in with biologics. But sure, we're going to have a first pass, but then the deeper cuts, you know, like on iTunes is, you know, deeper cuts. You have to think deeper cuts when you think about the broad range of organisms that can affect patients on biologics. So in this case, I think people send the diagnostics of some of the things people are thinking about. The sputum AFB, of course, you want to rule them out for TB with negative times three. Sputum AFB cultures were negative. Respiratory virus, PCR, very important in Hong Kong in the winter or you know, even during the year here in the United States, depending on what's going around. Negative. Chest CT scan after the chest x-ray showed sort of like a diffuse infiltrate, showed these ground glass opacities. And the BAL DFA was positive for pneumocystis. HIV antibody was positive. He wasn't known to be positive prior. And the diagnosis was pneumocystis pneumonia. His T cells were actually above about 300, so it was kind of interesting that he got pneumocystis in that context. And he was treated with clindamycin and primaquine because he was trim sulfur allergic and started on antiretroviral therapy. Another case this is a case that we saw a few months ago, HIV negative man, 74-year-old, interstitial lung disease and chronic lymphocytic leukemia. He was started on this new biologic called idelalisib. You can say it 10 times and see if you can say it fast. Admitted with progressive shortness of breath on exertion and dry cough for 1 month. He was also diagnosed with pneumocystis pneumonia. So we've been seeing more and more PCP on biologics. There's no guidance yet about starting PCP prophylaxis on patients on biologics. I guess, you know, some of these reports take about 10 years to really amass into enough so that people can issue standardized guidelines. But we haven't, we're not there yet. But there's one study that did a retrospective analysis of about 2,000 patients with relapse CLL or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the patients were put on this particular biologic with co-therapy with rituximab and or rituximab plus another agent. And the relative risk for PCP was 12.5, and the median time to diagnosis of PCP was 141 days. There's no standard PCP prophylaxis guidelines, and basically there was another report in New England Journal showing that with this particular agent, which is not a TNF-alpha inhibitor, but it's basically another kind of biologic that I'm not going to really categorize for you, call a kinase inhibitor for malignancies, that there was an uptick in PCP. I guess the point of this case is not that you have to necessarily know one bug with one drug, but rather keep your eyes open and keep your mind open for whatever the patient presents with, because there may be things that we don't know about in terms of complications from these drugs. Another case, real-life case coming from Boston, 69-year-old HIV-negative woman with low-grade lymphoma, treated only with rituximab, which is an anti-CD420 drug. Months after treatment, developed slowly progressive mental status changes. CSF-PCR is positive for JC virus and MRI consistent with PML, HIV-negative patient, and diagnosis was progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. And you see the imaging very consistent with that. So what do we see with, so we talked about mycobacterial disease with biologics, some fungal disease, endemic mycoses. What about viral diseases and biologics? Well, we see a lot of hepatitis B reactivation, particularly with rituximab. That's kind of the poster child of hepatitis B reactivation. So like was said yesterday, when you're thinking about somebody who might be core positive, antibody positive, and they'd been on Hep B active agents, and you're switching them to a less complicated regimen, and they may have lymphoma, and somebody's thinking about giving them rituximab, that's a situation where you may see hepatitis B reactivation as well. In terms of JC virus, there's a really strong uptick with rituximab, but there's less guidance on that, even though. But natalizumab, which has been very famous and reported with, and in terms of its association with PML, that is a sort of no-go for people who are even JC virus IgG positive. So prior to, some, say that your patient develops MS and they're thinking about giving them natalizumab, they're going to check a JC virus IgG serology. If that's positive, they're not going to give it just because of that strong association with PML. And then VZV, of course, we're seeing VZV, but it's not really reported because people are just, it's thought to be common, but very much associated with these biologics. So in the last part of the talk, what I'm going to do is talk about cancer immunotherapy. So it's the new exciting age of biologics. And the first, but this has been around for a while. So in the 1800s, there was a surgeon called Dr. Coley. He was from New York. And he was treating this patient with sarcoma on the face, pictured in that first panel. And he noticed that when the patient got sick, he had this URI or something like that, his sarcoma started melting away. And he tried to probably have one of the first startups in New York, where he's from, by commoditizing this observation. He actually took a bunch of bacteria from other patients and put it in a cocktail, and he called it Coley's Mixed Toxins, and he tried to sell it as a cure-all for cancer based on this observation. It didn't really work, but he said that it worked. But it was the first evidence that, you know, our immune system being activated, even for something else, can probably have benefits for malignancies as well. So this is the era of Jimmy Carter beating metastatic melanoma that goes to the brain. That's usually 100% mortality, but because of checkpoint blockade inhibitors, Jimmy Carter is alive and cancer-free today. So these checkpoint blockade inhibitors are probably, they're very much in the news now. This study was one done a few months ago by Lena Gandhi, who's Monica Gandhi's and Raj Gandhi's sibling. So it's kind of a very smart family. So it showed the use of one of these checkpoint blockade inhibitors, pembrolizumab, for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. So These cancers, depending on the cancer, they're melting away. People are very much investigating these agents. But how do they work? Well, some of the first studies actually came across the bay from UCSF at Berkeley when Jim Allison was there. And he won the Nobel Prize this year for medicine based on his work on checkpoint blockade inhibitors. And you can look at those mice to try to understand what sort of problems you can get while taking these checkpoint blockade inhibitors. So these are mice in some of the first studies looking at treatment of melanoma with one of these checkpoint blockade inhibitors called a CTLA-4. And what you can see is that as you activate the immune system a ton, you're going to get more autoimmune disease. You're going to get more skin and hair depigmentation because some of these agents attack the melanin in the skin. So these were some of the first, I guess people knew, these scientists knew that activating the immune system, like we know very well in HIV medicine, doesn't only has some disadvantages as well. How do checkpoint blockade inhibitors work? Well, basically, when you have an infection, your immune system is activated evolutionarily. But the body has a way to deal with overactivation by putting the brakes on it, and that's called a blockade to the immune activation, a checkpoint to the immune activation. Sorry. So when you block that brake to the immune system, you have like unfettered immune activation, and that works and is important in cancer because what happens is that the immune cells become very tolerant to the malignancy floating around and resistant, so that particularly in cases of metastatic disease, they can kind of zoom in after them. And that's really what's seen with some of these solid organ tumors where these checkpoint blocking inhibitors have been investigated. So this is a case, a real-life case, again, of an HIV-infected patient from Ward 86 at San Francisco General Hospital, 52-year-old male, HIV, well-controlled, skin squamous cell cancer, enrolled in AMC trial on nivolumab, which is a checkpoint blockade inhibitor, for 1 year, coming in with fecal incontinence and diarrhea. The diagnosis was checkpoint inhibitor-associated colitis. So these immune cells can go to different organs, including the kidneys, the gut, the skin, and cause these presentations that look very much like infection. So first of all, they're important for us to know because you might think it's an infection. You still have to work it up like as such. But then, more importantly, you use anti-inflammatory agents like TNF-alpha and some of these drugs we talked about at the early part of the talk to treat this immune activation. So because you're using something to block the immune activation, those things that you're using to block, like TNF-alpha or prednisone, they are going to increase the risk of infection to the patient. So finally, CAR T cells, what are they? This is one of the first patients treated at UCSF, a kid in Benioff Children's Hospital. It's really amazing. It's like science fiction of medicine. You basically take the patient's T cells from them. You sensitize them to the tumor. You ship the T cells to LA, like we ship them to this factory in LA. And in LA, they activate the T cells from the patient, and they multiply the T cells, they ship it back to UCSF, and then we inject it into the patient. And then these activated T cells, they like zoom all over the body and cure the malignancy. And that's basically what's happening. But what happens with these activated T cells is that you get this inflammatory response, and you have to give something to quiet down the inflammatory response pretty much all the time in CAR T cells. And that thing that you give increases the risk of infection, like TNF-alpha inhibitors. What do you do with your patient in front of you prior to thinking about TNF-alpha inhibitor use? Well, you think about immune reconstitution. I think people are still relatively conservative in HIV in terms of waiting for T cells above 200. Again, it depends on the risk-benefit ratio. Think about drug interactions. Think about TB risk like we talked about. Think about endemic mycoses and fungi, hepatitis B, and then vaccines. You want to think about giving them Shingrix before, because you know there's going to be an association of zoster with some of these agents. While taking the biologic, think about checking their immune function. I think probably this is one of the cases where you wouldn't not check the CD4 count, but probably would check it every 3 to 6 months, depending on what agent you're using. thinking about when a patient presents, that it may not just be an infection, but an activated immune system that you may have to think about. Live vaccines are usually contraindicated, even if their T cells are above the threshold for normal use. And then being vigilant is probably the biggest take-home point for you. We don't have time to go through this email, but this is just like some of the emails I'd get about when to start. And the data in HIV is not really robust. There is some, just this one report showing that, but we probably can get many more cases, even from this audience alone. It just hasn't been published yet, showing that people are generally starting above, you know, 200 to 300, and they do pretty well once they're started on these biologics for a variety of conditions. So we talked about some of the conditions. We talked about some of the mechanism of actions of some of the new agents. We talked about infectious as well as other complications. And we talked about strategies before starting and during biologic use in your HIV-infected patients. So thanks a lot for your attention. And I hope at least you have an approach. Keep vigilant. Own those drugs, even if you can't pronounce them.
Questions from the audience?
Hello. Steve Johnson from the University of Colorado. Kind of a two-part question. One is, do you have a resource that you use for making decisions on OI prophylaxis based on different immunobiologics and so on? That's always hard. And then kind of related to that is, how do you incorporate the immunobiologics in terms of modifying decisions for PCP prophylaxis, stopping and starting, and things like that?
So those are great questions. Unfortunately, there's no one resource, because what's happening, just like with TNF-alpha inhibitors, which are the oldest agents we have in this group of drugs, is that it takes many, many years for some of these signals to come through. Just like neural tube defects, you know, with antiretroviral therapy. So I think right now that when you look at guidelines, they're actually very simplistic. They just say, you know, check your TB risk before starting, and, you know, maybe think about endemic mycoses, but there is no guidance even on endemic mycoses. I mean, I think as we move forward, some of these guidelines will become more concrete and robust, but it's challenging because the drugs have so many different mechanisms of action, and there's so many different types of drugs, and our patients are so heterogeneous, but I think really what's more important is just really two things: having an approach, at least with the basic things that we know, and then number two, just being vigilant and reporting these things when they happen. I think, you know, inspired by this talk and this audience and some of the other people I've talked to, I think we will probably try to at least pool some of the resources of people in the HIV community taking care of patients with these agents, so at least we can come to some better guidelines than the 37 cases that have already been published. And in terms of OI prophylaxis, again, it's really difficult. Even now with that uptick in PCP with rituximab, there is no guidance about starting PCP prophylaxis. So, you know, I think it's a tough situation. Again, guidelines go on more robust data. We just don't have the robust data. There's some data with TB and, for example, but not in some of these other opportunistic infections.
So it's just, hi.
Hi.
This is a great talk. And I did not know that's what all those words meant, so that was great. The situation we have is, a lot of times we'll get called by one of our colleagues who's taking care of a HIV-positive patient of ours who's going to put them on a biologic. And the conversation always goes like, hey, you know, we're thinking of doing this. And I say, yeah, he's in great shape. And they say, so is there anything additional you want me to do besides what I usually do? And I'm busily going to up to date to see what they usually do. And trying to stall usually doesn't work. So my question is, you know, healthy, virologically suppressed patient that's being put on one of these agents, other than sort of increased vigilance, making sure TB and RA are probably histo, Hep B issues are addressed, it's really just being more aware of it. Is there anything else I should do?
No, I think at this point it's just being aware of it. I mean, I think these drugs are miraculous for patients when they get put on it and they're so debilitated and you're trying to get them off prednisone. So it's really the risk-benefit conversation that you have with a patient. I think in most cases, you know, when we've looked even at those 37 published cases and our collective experience, apart from a few cases, people have done generally well.
So we have several questions. We'll try to do some of these quickly. Do you have a recommendation for an article or learning tool for people to become more familiar with these drugs?
So an article or learning tool, there's no really great resource. Actually, in the IS, I'm working with the IS USA to publish something by the end of this year. So in the next episode, you'll at least have this approach that we talked about. But there's really no unified chapter or book because they're all over the place and it's such a fast-moving target. But I guess, so the approach is really, it sounds really simplistic, but it's really what we're emphasizing. And just understanding where to put your patient's drug in that categorization I showed you, rather than knowing, like, this drug is associated with that because then you go crazy. But is it, like, an adaptive immunity drug? Is it, like, an innate immunity drug? And is it one of those things that we talked about? And then that will lead you to think about what you need to check before starting.
Yeah, thank you. Great talk. A comment and a question. The comment is I see a lot of patients over the years that have been referred to me because HIV was diagnosed during the workup for an autoimmune disease that they were thinking of putting somebody on one of these drugs. In those situations, almost invariably say, let's treat the HIV, get the viral load suppressed, and almost to the one, the autoimmune diseases resolve because it's due to the active viral load. And just to be aware of that situation, right. Delay your colleagues and say, let's see what we have left over once we get the viral load under control. And so stopping before it starts in those situations. The comment is on the flip side of that, it's only because we are treating individuals successfully for so long, we're starting to see this blip again in autoimmune diseases. The cancer diagnoses aside, which autoimmune diseases are you seeing more commonly in HIV-infected patients with long-term successful treatment? Are there certain categories that are seeming to overlap more often? Thank you.
So, yeah, in terms of your first comment, I think that's a great observation, the fact that at the beginning, if somebody's concomitantly diagnosed with HIV and an autoimmune disease together, or the HIV becomes apparent in the workup of the autoimmune disease, give it some time, which the rheumatologists usually do anyway. They wouldn't start biologics immediately because a patient's autoimmune disease may actually get moderated by you treating the HIV disease. The second point about what are we seeing in terms of autoimmune disease in the era of patients living longer with HIV? I think it's a complicated question. I don't know if, Laurie, you have any thoughts about that. But, I mean, yeah.
They're getting older.
So I think it's going to be, you know, that smattering in terms of where the uptick is precisely and in which autoimmune disease. I think it's just a smattering, and what I understand in this as mirroring the general population, but not anything that's different in terms of Crohn's disease, you know, we've been seeing a lot of psoriasis, you know, lupus, even later in life, rheumatoid arthritis for sure.
Great talk. Question. On the IGRAs, do these drugs modify that test, or because it's an ex vivo test, it's pretty straightforward use?
That's a great question. The question is, do the biologics modify the test characteristics for QuantiFERON or any IGRAs? And the question, the general answer is no in general, although we hate to get that sort of like indeterminate result back when we do. But these are not like, it's not like unless your patient is getting a transplant, HIV-infected transplant. We know in transplant situation, post-transplant, when you deplete T cells like very intentionally, those patients may sometimes have false negatives.
Okay, so quick quick question and quick answers. We've got several here I want to get to.
Thank you for your talk. Alex Dorick, University of Nebraska Medical Center. I had a patient who is not taking his meds, unfortunately, and developed an acquired hemophilia A. He's gotten better on prednisone. There's talk of maybe using rituximab if we can get it approved. But there's no guidance on when to prophylax. And again, his viral load is absolutely not controlled. His CD4 count is still okay, and we're trying to work with them and figure out what the barrier is. Anything that have you seen, run into that, or anything you do about prophylaxing him, just empirically?
No, I would probably have to mirror on the side of the rituximab is associated certainly with probably one of the. A very powerful anti-B cell drug. So the association with PCP is probably the next, the most important OI that we see, but there's no national guidelines yet about that. So, you know, I can't really give you a sort of globally vetted report, except to, again, when the patient comes in and it looks like he has a pneumonia, look for PCP in that particular patient. Think about hepatitis B. You know, screening, that's really, really a strong signal in terms of reactivation of Hep B post rituximab. And then there, you know, these reports with rituximab and PML.
Yes or no, would you put someone who's an elite controller on HIV medication before you started one of these medications?
I think I'd probably want to treat, there's no urgency to use these biologics in general. Particularly for autoimmune disease. So your rheumatologist generally has like a few months while they're sort of discussing with you risk-benefit ratio. During that time, I would generally use the sequence of treat HIV first, particularly because that may modify the natural history of the autoimmune disease itself. And then while engaging with the rheumatologist, sometimes with oncology, you can't wait, in which case, you know, that's going to be, you know, you need to make that decision faster.
Okay, is there any evidence that people on immunobiologics are more susceptible to HIV infection?
That's a great question. Are people who are on biologics more susceptible to HIV infection because you're just basically activating the immune system based on the biologic that you use? That's a, you know, really interesting question. People haven't looked at that, but I think very plausible, just like, you know, when you have an SCD and you recruit inflammatory cells to the site where you're going to get HIV exposure, it's plausible, but no one has looked at that.
Okay, well, thank you very much.